and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and our guest today, David Anderson. How you doing, David?
I'm doing great.
Dave, you're on the show because you recently published a book with 1517 called Faithless to Fearless. It's an apologetic work, which is cool. I think it's the first properly apologetic work we've published in over a year.
Over a year.
So, great addition to our catalog, and you have been / are going to be, a little paradox for our listeners there, doing an episode dedicated to that book. But in the back of the book, you have a postscript on happiness that I thought would make just an interesting show topic, the idea of happiness. And so we're going to do that today. But before we dive into the episode, I want to remind people that Thank You Fellows is part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcast to see all of those shows. You can get the catalogs on the website there, but what I really encourage people to do is to jump from the website to their favorite podcasting app and go subscribe on the show. You can catch us on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Podcast Addict, basically anywhere podcasts are found, and you can go subscribe. And then we're also still trying to get more ratings for the show. So we're approaching that 500 ratings number. If you could help us out this week, if you haven't done that already, this is actually a great time in the episode to pause the show, go write a review on iTunes, and then resume. What do you guys think?
Yeah, it's like car sales, right? Only 5 stars
count. Only 5 stars count. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, if you want to give us a 2-star rating, just...
We have one.
Don't do it.
Talk to your wife about how much you hate the show instead. Yeah.
If you have a problem, I have said this in the past, if you have a problem with the show, like if you've been listening to it and you feel like you really couldn't give it a 5-star review because you felt like that was dishonest, I would be curious why, and I would take that email just to see what the critique of the show is. We do have 1 3-star review out there that I thought was pretty funny that was just saying, I think these guys are unfair to evangelicals, which I think
fair
there
enough.
Was...
Fair enough.
Yeah, fair enough. I think fair enough. There were a series of episodes. I don't, you know...
It was me. It's fair enough.
Yeah.
Where if there's a Calvinist out there that gives us a 3-star to Prague, fair enough.
These guys hate Calvinists. Yeah. No. Well, maybe... No, not really.
Unknown fact, David Anderson and I, the first time we met was at Rod's house before going to Westminster Seminary to participate in a debate with Calvinists from that seminary.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, Scott, that was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago. I recall it not being a very great night on the whole.
Yeah.
But other than that.
Interesting.
So he likes Calvinists as much as I do.
Yeah, yeah.
What were you guys debating? Lord's
Although
Supper?
Although I was always called one by Spare.
Lord's Supper, yeah. Lord's Supper.
Yeah.
Wow, Lutherans have been debating that with Calvinists for approximately 500 years, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of funny that that one never stops, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Well, interesting. So let's get into this episode. Dear listener, are you happy? Is I question, are you happy with your life? Are you happy with your marriage? Are you happy with your job? A lot of happiness talk going
I'm
around now.
Obviously,
right?
Very happy.
Well, you got a huge smile on your face.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're clearly happy.
Clearly.
Yeah, so this is a really common question for people, personal happiness, right? I think
it is.
The postscript of the book introduces, I thought the dynamic that we seem in modern Western culture to believe that it's a human right to be happy. Not even sort of like the classical pursuit of happiness is sort of a right, but actual attaining that happiness is something that all people should be able to do or have. And
we're obsessed with it. I mean, we're ending marriages, we're leaving jobs. And what's interesting is that every objective indicator of well-being, such as, you know, access to healthcare, music, and
wealth,
is on the rise.
Size of house.
Exactly.
Access to, you know, luxuries that before our age were unknown.
Yeah. Yeah, since 1960, depression has been sharply on the rise.
It's worse with your generation, Caleb. It's a huge epidemic.
Yeah, I was reading. Was it your book that talked about suicidality was more like 30 years ago or something was more, or most common in 29-year-olds or something?
Well,
like that?
No, it's depression. So the first episode of depression, the average age, well, it used to be 29, now it's 14.
That's a pretty dramatic
shift. That's dramatic.
And that's the first incident where somebody describes themselves as being like clinically depressed.
Right.
Or is diagnosed as clinically depressed. So that's 15 years younger.
That's a dramatic shift.
Yeah. Suicidality among what they call young adults, which is typically, I mean, the number changes, but it's like 15 to 25-year-old type things, is suicidality itself. Now, not suicide, right? Mm-hmm. But suicidality kind of classically defined as not only expressing the desire to kill oneself, but also then expressing the fact that they have a plan and they have the means to carry out the plan.
Mm-hmm.
Is in the 40-ish percentile in young adults, once a year too. So it's not like just a fleeting thing. At least once a year, they've felt this way and or expressed that to someone else.
So is it hard to peg down exactly what we mean when we say happiness? Because part of it's, you know, affective, it's emotion. Or is there like a clinical definition that is sort of agreed upon in this space?
That's a really good question.
A definition of happiness?
Yeah, because I know when I was, you know, taking more philosophy classes, in order to avoid the happiness question, usually it was replaced with human flourishing, which was then given attributes which you could sort of statistically look at.
Yeah.
But with happiness, it seems like that would be more self-attested.
It's a really vague concept. And if you look in history, back to even Plato and Aristotle, they disagreed on how it's attained, and I think it's really hard to peg down. I spend some time with positive psychology in this postscript, and it's one of the more clinically oriented disciplines now. So we've got some pretty good raw data behind what Martin Seligman calls well-being.
Yeah, reading your postscript, that you kind of define it almost like contentment for the most part. Like, you're okay with your state in life.
Yeah. And he has, you know, several ways that he measures happiness. Positive emotion is just one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Engagement, positive relationships, and that sort of thing. Meaning are part of that for him. But we've come a long way in gathering data around the topic that we didn't have before positive psychology came into being. So it's an interesting discipline.
I think some of this is interesting. I don't know if you remember, Caleb, and I was trying to talk to Dave about it last night, but I'm looking at it. It was back in 2016, so 4 years ago. Cindy Koch, who writes for 1517, and her book Woman is one of our books, wrote a blog on the Jagged Word called "The Happiness is for Babies." And she basically, I don't want to, you know, mis-summarize it, but kind of summarizing it is just this, she's reacting in the blog to what she sees everywhere, which is this, that people seem to pursue happiness above all other pursuits. And this happiness, kind of like what Dave said at the beginning, is, you know, this pursuit of happiness will end marriages because I'm fighting all the time and I'm not happy. So I'm out. It'll end careers. Well, I'm go to work and I'm not happy at work. I don't feel happy, I guess I should say, at
right.
work. So I'm going to get another job, or I'm just going to stop working or whatever. And I remember reading this blog thinking that I think one of the problems here is just what you were touching on, Caleb, with how do you define happiness, right? If you're defining happiness sort of as this constant attempt to make yourself simply feel a certain way, then maybe happiness is babies, because babies, you know, they their life is determined by how they feel in the moment. You know, I feel good, I'm gonna smile, I feel gassy, I'm gonna fart, I feel bad, I'm gonna cry and scream, I feel like I have to go to the bathroom, I'm just gonna go no matter where I am, right? So their life is sort of determined just by how I feel, this is what I'm going to do. But I don't think that in philosophy or in sort of the history of ideas, when we talk about happiness, we're simply talking about how we feel in the moment. I think it's something deeper than that. And I think this is an American thing that we've exported, largely because of media and internet and all that, to the whole world, where Americans do feel very entitled to happiness. It's literally in our founding documents, right? The life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which I believe was originally the pursuit of property. But since educationally we don't sort of have a grasp on what the debate was between Plato and Aristotle on happiness, mm-hmm. right? Or mm-hmm. what the debate has been throughout the history of ideas regarding what is this idea of happiness. And certainly that would have been part of the discussion in writing founding documents to include that would have been philosophy and the history of these ideas. And since we've lost that, it's easy for us to get mad at the pursuit of happiness, right? Or to react against it, like I would say Cindy did. But I think there's something here that's important. I think there's there's something that's being missed if we sort of just dismiss the idea of pursuing happiness at all. There's a quality of life here that, at least in creation as God originally intended it, was supposed to be part of the equation.
And certainly Paul talks a lot about joy, right? And when I look at those pictures of the heavenly liturgy in Revelations 4 and 5, obviously the word happiness is not used in those angelic scenes that John is depicting for us, but it's implied, right? When you're looking at the praise and giving glory to the Lamb who was slain, obviously, you're talking about some level of joy or happiness.
I guess I'd say it's implied, at least, that they're not miserable.
Right.
Well, there's a completeness which sort of gets to that. Like there is a part of you or all of you which is fulfilled.
Well, and my big fear, something with somebody that's saying like happiness is for babies, for instance, is that the average person is going to hear that and go, "Well, what is my life's pursuit supposed to be? Misery?"
Right.
I mean, I think it's fair enough to say, hey, be realistic about this world and this life and your place in it as a sinner, to understand that misery will be part of your life. I mean, just flat out, misery is going to be pain, suffering, all that's going to be part of your life. But that's not what God intended.
Well, and there's even a self...
Exactly.
Yeah, this is part of our state in sin. But one of the things about being a Christian, right, and being free from sin, death, and the power of the devil is I think at least partially, if you understand it right, the ability to pursue happiness again.
Yeah, the world is given back to us.
As long as you understand it. I just think it's funny. I remember when I wrote this blog, I was really curious if the scriptures ever referenced happiness, and I didn't. It's been a long time since I've looked at the Hebrew. But one of the sort of enduring translations of Psalm 144:15 is, happy are the people whose God is the Lord,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Specifically using that idea of happiness, but flipping it around, and Dave says this in his book, flipping, you know, your pursuit of happiness goes from, I'm pursuing everything just for my own selfish means, which is how we see it here, and if I pursue my own selfish means enough, I'll be happy, to I'm actually pursuing something for someone else, right?
Right. And interesting, Seligman, and again, I'll go back to Seligman. I have a lot to say about him in this postscript. He talks about the fact that we've had the self-esteem peddlers. Throughout.
I grew up with it, right? Yeah.
And you guys could probably speak
as
well.
That's American practical philosophy.
Exactly. But they've made us obsess over how we're feeling at every single moment.
Right. Yep.
And Seligman's point is the only thing we've done is created an entire generation of narcissists.
Yeah, and with a distinct difference between those who understand the inherent value and worth of life and developing somebody an idea of self-worth that's based on not only the self but the other, right, in relation to the self, and self-esteem, which is simply how you feel about yourself.
Right.
Self-worth is something that can be measured, can be objective in a sense. Self-esteem will never be objective. Esteem is just how you feel about yourself, in that, which is constantly changing, which is probably, you know, lends a lot to this depression and suicidality. It's the same. I mean,
it causes reflection on what's wrong with me if I don't have
this. Is not self-esteem, not different than basing your faith on something objective or your faith on just how you feel.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I agree.
Like Rod used to say, if I'm basing my faith just on how I feel in the moment or the burning in the bosom, so to speak, how do I know that's not the pepperoni pizza I had last night?
Yep.
Yep. You don't, and you never will.
Yep. One of the things I talk about in the postscript is that positive psychology has brought us a long way. The research is really interesting. They've talked a lot about the difference between a pessimistic and an optimistic explanatory style. And I think that that has a lot of application for Christians. I mean, of all people, I think that we're the most, we have the most reason to be optimistic. But then there's, I believe, a big place for the pessimism. Namely, let's look at the brutal reality that we live in. And I would sort of equate that with what the Reformers talked about with the law of gospel. You know, the law condemns us, shows us our sin. The gospel, on the other hand, frees us from sin. But I think the things that positive psychology has brought to the table are very important, but I think they've missed an important point. And the point is they didn't deal with sin.
Yeah, they can't.
They can't deal with sin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
The one that kind of can, and you bring it up in your book, is cognitive behavioral therapy. Can kind of deal with the idea that your view of things might be broken, which I guess would be their view of sin, right?
Certainly an effect. I mean, I would argue it's an effect of sin, right? The stories we tell ourselves. I don't know if you've ever read Brené Brown's Rising Strong. I'm a big fan of Brené Brown. But she talks about those stories that loop through our head that are mostly untrue,
right?
Mm-hmm. About people and about situations, right. And that is something that cognitive therapy can come.
Yeah, into. I mean, teaches you to seek out sort of the more objective view of the thing that you're looping on, right?
Right, right.
So
yeah, it teaches you to challenge them.
I did some of the research for my MA, which is about the interaction between literature and theology, and dealt with the idea of your inner literary narrative in your head psychologically and sort of how that affected the way people lived, and people who had a narrative which included something that we might call sin, some sort of fall, which then either by strength or some external force had things to overcome, were generally much more mentally healthy than people who either are conquered and remain conquered in their own personal literary narrative, or people who never sort of actually had anything to overcome, but life has been nothing but upward trajectory.
Right.
It's related to sort of a mental health and depression.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting you said, of all people, Christians have sort of a perspective that can be positive, right?
Yeah.
It reminded me right off the bat when you said that of Romans 5 and Paul talking about hope, right? Mm-hmm. Which is sort of this, you know, you're hopeful of things to come. You have sort of this possibly positive perspective on what is going to come. But it's interesting. The first thing I thought of is that in 3 and 4 of Romans 5, in verses 3 and 4 of Romans 5, he sort of strings together how you get to this hope. And it's, in our day, this would not be how we would approach being hopeful, right? It's, but we also glory in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, character, and character, here's the end goal, hope, right? If you're going to be hopeful, if you're going to have a positive outlook in life, and possibly if you're eventually going to be happy, you have to know that there's some crawling through the weeds before you get there.
Yeah.
It's not just, and this is the thing that I think we struggle with a lot in our day, is it's not just instantaneous because I want it to be. I want to be happy, thus I should be happy. And then when I'm not happy, boom, you know, there's a major crash. Which, when I was the associate dean at the university and working with, you know, the 1,000 residential students every day on this, is that the one thing was most apparent to me is that generationally there's been this sort of, they've been taught, your generation for the most part has been taught, and younger have been taught, that there's been such a focus on keeping them safe and keeping them protected and keeping them cared for. And, you know, classically in the conferences that I used to go to, it was the debate over snowplow versus helicopter parents versus whatever parents, you know, that have protected him their whole lives. And with this idea that if they can be protected and if they can live in this little bubble enough, that they'll be able to attain everything they've ever wanted to attain. Which means they'll be happy, right? They'll go to the playoffs in soccer. That'll get them a college scholarship. They'll go to college. They'll get the business degree. then they'll get the perfect internship, and then right after the internship, they'll get the job running the company. And somewhere along the way, they'll meet somebody, get married, have the 2.5 kids, and it'll all be peach keen, and they'll be happy, and it'll just boom, boom, boom happen. And what I noticed is, you know, the minute one of those students got a D on a paper, it was like life-ending.
Shutdown mode.
Life-ending. And parents are involved, and vice presidents are involved, and the whole world's involved to address the fact that something completely normal happened. You know, a student who entered academia didn't, on the first paper they ever wrote, get an A++. Perfectly normal.
Yep.
We have to bring in the entire cavalry to see what the problem is. And I think this is, it's devastating. It's devastating. I think some of this crawling through the weeds, as I kind of put Romans 5, 3, and 4, it's just, you can't take it out of life.
You can't. And one of the things that I talk about in the postscript is, I refer to Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life. Excuse me. That's the title of the book.
We've talked about it many times on the show.
Great. I've gone back to that book many, many times. It was interesting because he quotes Jung, who says a tree can't grow to heaven unless its roots grow down to hell. And his take on Jung's comment is that who really wants to see who's at the bottom of those most wicked thoughts?
Right.
And thus his comment that's why enlightenment is so rare. But quite frankly, for the Christian, this is critical, right? Yeah. There is confession that happens before absolution. We need to understand the sin. We need to understand who lies at the bottom of that well. Before we can receive forgiveness. The law does its work and makes way for the gospel.
And the regular absolution and the means of grace make it possible to live in a world which you realize and you know is completely corrupt and sinful and still live a meaningful life in that,
right,
in that world.
Right. Now, in Moltmann's terms, it makes the inhuman human again.
Right. Now, as I have to do anytime Jordan B. Peterson's name is mentioned on this podcast, I'll say that... I do like Jordan Peterson. I have read both of his books. I find much value there, but I also find that there's much that needs to be addressed. I did write a paper on that subject, which you can find at 1517.org. And as always, I invite him to come on the podcast to debate me at any point.
Yeah. he's an interesting guy, but of course, we'd have many disagreements with George Peterson.
So Peterson and that quote about the tree, and also your sort of example about the student who gets the D the first time, does it makes me think about some of those students I was around, right? And sometimes that first D, or that is this trickle down,
or first boyfriend breakup,
yeah,
girlfriend too, probably.
Is this trickle down to, I don't want to call it a total shutdown, but sort of a giving up, right? Like, it was not uncommon. This is anecdotal, but it was not uncommon to hear students at Concordia chant "D's get degrees" and things like this, right?
What does that mean?
Well, that's because it means you can get a bachelor's degree getting D's.
Okay, yeah.
In anything but your major courses, a D is a passing grade.
But there's two reactions to this. There's sort of the hyper protected student that will, you know, that is going to crumble every time something bad happens. And then there's sort of the extremely callous person that
just sort of lives with it.
Yeah, it just sort of lives with it. And I, you know, I think that in my experience while I was there, the hyper-protected student was much more common. I think that there's a certain segment of people that, you know, go into a field that's kind of easy to get into and maybe shouldn't even require a bachelor's degree to get into the field. And, you know, they're not very studious and... they know coming to college, and maybe especially the one they chose to go to, is they can kind of skate.
I guess my point is I've seen not only at school but in other areas this group of people who, when that sort of adversity comes, the idea of overcoming it sort of just shuts down.
Yeah.
It's just sort of like, just keep taking the hits, just keep taking the hits.
I don't know. I mean, that's probably true. I think on the subject line, I think that one of the things I was addressing is this idea that happiness just happens, you know, that it's just, it should be, that it's kind of just something that's automatic. And it's not, You know, it's not. And again, it depends on how you define it. I guess I think it's interesting to say, you know, how do you define this thing? And I think it's something that you have to look outside of yourself for. I think it's much like anything. If you navel gaze on this one, you're going to find what we always find when we navel gaze, which is our sin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just period.
And it's going to create anxiety.
It's going to create anxiety. And you'll never be looking outside. You'll never be looking to the cross. You'll never be looking to those people that God has put into your lives for you to serve and to be served, to forgive and to be forgiven by. You'll never do that. You'll do what I think they call in cognitive behavioral therapy, you'll loop. You'll loop on mm-hmm. your sin, you know,
mm-hmm.
round and round and round again. And it might be a particular set of shortcomings. It might be your general shortcomings or your universal shortcomings, but whatever. And it's happiness, if it is attainable at all, it's attained, I think, by, in a sense, ceasing this desire to only find it for yourself and within yourself.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that sounds right. Again, anecdotally, some of the happiest things I reflect on were at the time, now the hardest things, right? Like the hardest moments in life are mm-hmm. very challenging, which now sort of, when you look back on them, bring me a sense of joy, accomplishment, things like that. And I think, you know, we talk about the society. The other thing I hear is just a lot of like, we have a lot of, there's an end goal, which is not working anymore, retiring, your kids being out of the house, sort of like everything that constitutes doing life being gone so that you can just have you and your pursuits,
mm-hmm.
to whatever that means. And I think we see that, especially now that it was either last year or it's this year that it's like 40% of the population will now be 65 or older, which is retirement age. So now it's this massive portion of the population where that sort of, that end goal, what's supposed to be really happy, which is getting rid of all the responsibility in life and just focusing on you, is here for just a massive segment of the population. And does that mean that, is that percentage of the population now truly happier? Now that sort of service to somebody outside of them is gone.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
They're just not. I wrote about this in my friendship book, is that, you know, men especially tend to be less happy the older they get. And a lot of that's attributed to just like their purpose, right?
They lose it.
Yeah, it's gone, right? Their kids are grown. They maybe don't see their grandkids. They've retired. They don't have a career. They sit around the house all day watching TV, getting fat, and wondering what's left for them. And they don't have, for the context of the friendship book, they don't have good friends. They haven't spent time in their life developing good friendships. And they're, you know, I read a lot of sort of obscure books, a lot of them about people who've built sort of like businesses in remote parts of America. But it's interesting to me, there's sort of you can see two perspectives on this. I'll read a book by someone who built this great empire, right? Say, and they did it at the expense of spending time with their family.
Yeah.
And they have this thing that I look at and I think is great. Wow, look at what you've did. I really wish I could do that, XYZ. And then you find this little passage in their book that says, but my biggest regret in life is that I didn't spend any time with my kids. You know, and then you read another book. This last one I read is called The Last of the Bush Pilots by this Harmon Helmerich's guy. I mean, I think it was published in the 60s.
Is it out of print? Or like,
oh,
how'd you get it?
Yeah, it's
okay.
And, you know, he built a very small business that was very focused on his family and sort of their little homestead in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And you get this little line at the very end of his book, and I'm so happy that my family was a part of this every step of the way. Mm-hmm. And now my son, you know, is a bush pilot with me, and we guide and da-da-da-da-da. And it's just such a different perspective. You were saying the hardest thing, people look back and the hardest things they've ever done are the happiest times in their life, right? I think that's why so many, and I hope.
But it's only in retrospect. And that's the problem.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say, is it's like parenting is that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like you look back on it and when you're in the thick of it, you're like, oh my gosh, this is, every day is just a drag. But you, once your kids are grown and you look back on it and all you can say to yourself is, that was the happiest time of my life. And you know that in each moment.
It wasn't.
It wasn't, right?
Yeah.
You can remember all of the struggles. You can remember all of the fights. You can remember the headaches and the worry and the everything. But you look back on it, and all you want to create again is that time where your kids are close and I mean, that's all you want.
And don't move too quickly through the tough times. Don't want to get out of the tough times too quickly. I have a lot to say. Well, not a lot. I reference Ray Dalio in my book a few times, who is the founder of Bridgewater. And Bridgewater is a financial firm, and we've got 1,500-plus employees. He wrote a best-selling managed book that I would regard as the best management book written in the last 15 years. It's called Principles. But in that book, he says, look, learn to enjoy the pain somewhat, because
that brings me to something.
As you move through the pain, you're learning something very valuable, and don't try to get through it too quickly.
Yeah, I have this interesting. I think it's an interesting question. One of our authors almost got to the real interesting part recently, but I think there's something interesting about the fact that human beings sort of seek out painful endeavors, and they. For the good that they can do. And I specifically think this is interesting in a human context. I would say my friends and I backpacked the Escalante National Wilderness a couple years ago. It's probably one of the most painful things I've ever done. I mean, it was every day was just a freaking poison ivy, near-death-infested slog for 12 hours. But we did it to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we didn't... We weren't in the military. We weren't taking some hill. We did it to ourselves. And we look back on it as a very character-building time. You know, I think it's interesting that in our society, we kind of want happiness without the slog.
Yes.
And I also think it's interesting that we so often associate pain and enduring hardship as bad. Maybe even sinful in a way, right? When in reality, those of us who sort of want to be happy, we seek it out. I mean, I want to be happy.
Yeah,
I mean, I can't stand it when somebody says happiness isn't a good end goal. I think that's stupid. I want to be happy. Like,
well, who doesn't, right?
Right.
I mean, we're obsessed with it. And
I just think that there's more. It's not a one thing. It's like there's happiness, there's contentment, there's fulfillment, and how does that come? That comes, you know, by understanding what's the priority, who you are in this universe in relation to your God, who you are in this world in relation to the people God has put into your life, your family, your loved ones, your people that work with and work for you, and friends, and the whole nine yards, right? I just think our view on this is so narrow.
It is, and we've come to the understanding that we should aim for happiness directly, focus on it.
Yeah, I think,
and I would argue
that's
that
it's
a consequence of something else.
Yeah, totally agree.
It's a consequence of a life lived meaningfully.
Aim on the things that produce it.
Yes.
Not on it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and that's why I argue good. In this postscript that the human sin has to be dealt with. One cannot be happy. Truly, unless we deal with the problem of guilt and sin and everything that comes with it, anxiety and everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, even if you look at like pop heroes from sports to business to academia or whatever, right? There's sort of as a viewer in a society that has just a lot of consumerism, right? It can look very easy. You look like your favorite basketball star was just by fate. Given those talents,
yep.
right? And that there was no building.
And that is
up.
Not the truth.
Or the star student at your university who just seems to skate through the homework so much easier than you, or something like that. That comes like with a lot of work.
It does.
And TV sort of gets rid of that work and shows you just the results, right?
So that's interesting you bring that up. I just wrote a chapter for the book that I'm working on now. I wrote a chapter on expertise because there's been an entire science built around the idea of expertise.
On the 10,000 hours?
it's roughly that. That's not necessarily... I mean, Malcolm Gladwell came up with the 10,000 hour thing, but there's some truth to that. But the fact the reality is it takes a lot of time to develop expertise in any field.
Right.
And a lot of pain.
Yep.
And a lot of ritual, I would argue.
Yeah.
So what you say is absolutely the truth, and there's been a lot of good work done on this.
I was just looking at this blog that I wrote years ago. And
you got the name of it so I can put it in the notes?
I'll send it. Yeah, it's... what is it called here? Let me hold on. don't worry, be happy, just because I'm a funny guy. So this is from Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis, who does this, and I love it because it's got a car analogy, so that's good for me. He says, God made us, invented us as a man invents an engine. A car is made to run on petrol, and it would not run properly on anything else, unless it's diesel.
Electricity. No, just kidding.
Now God designed the human machine to run on himself. He himself is the fuel for our spirits, or he himself is the fuel our spirits were designed to burn, or the food our spirits were designed to feed us. There is no other. That is why it is just no good asking God to make us happy in our own way without bothering about religion. God cannot give us a happiness and peace apart from himself,
mm-hmm.
because it is not there.
Mm-hmm.
It's from Mere Christianity.
That's interesting. You know, it's, even go back 5 minutes in the conversation about sort of happiness pursued through the things that are difficult or hard, or even retrospectively looking back at it, you know, for Christians, to bring this back around for this episode, the thing which fulfills us totally, redeems us, absolves us, is actually the most gruesome thing in the world,
mm-hmm.
which is the death of God on a cross being punished for sins which aren't his, right? It's sort of, it wasn't an easy thing. It wasn't like a snap of the happy Jesus, the laughing Jesus or something like this. It was the suffering Christ, which...
Outside of the city gates, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Alienated from society, alienated from his own people. Yeah.
I said that yesterday when I was teaching on parables. I'm like, you're listening to teachings that were given by a man from the outside to people who are on the inside. That's why if you're on the inside, a lot of this stuff doesn't make sense to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's sort of that final promise to us of life everlasting is... by being joined to that suffering, in that death with Christ. It's not skirting this life, which is sort of, you know, some of the goal of like Gnostic or even monasticism, which is
right.
which is funny because on the surface it looks like suffering, right? But it's really just a self-indulgence. It's a self-serving suffering. It's a pious suffering, which is turn you something which avoids happiness or something like that because it's of this world. When Christ calls us back into that world so that if and when we suffer, it's not just so that we can attain something in heaven, but it's actually for other, it's vocational and mm-hmm. in this aspect, right? We suffer for others, even if, when we suffer for ourselves, it's not just suffering for suffering's sake.
Right, right.
There's a fulfillment there of sort of the human condition.
Right. I should mention this because I was talking to my wife about this before, but I'm a big Pixar fan. We watch too many kids' movies because we have twin 10-year-old boys. But one of my favorite movies is Inside Out. And it's actually quite brilliant because of the way they depict human emotions and the different... inclinations within each one of us, but to go to your point, they at the end of the movie, I don't know if you did you see Inside Out?
Esther just watched it the other day, but I was doing stuff around the
watch
house.
Watch it again because at the end of this show, they depict these memories as little balls that then get stored down into long term memory, and at the end it shows a ball that is. On the one side, joy, and then the other side, happiness, and it's quite brilliant because they're suggesting that as we mature, joy comes as a result of sadness a lot of the times, and for a kid's movie, it's quite deep. I love it. I love Pixar. I'm a big Pixar fan.
Well, that's good. We talk about a lot of Avengers on this show, so
yeah.
Storytelling is. Massively important.
Yeah,
to people. It helps them reflect and see who they are in the world.
Yeah. Hey, Caleb, are you doing an MA thesis on storytelling?
Only a little one.
Okay.
Yeah. If I might finish it one day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how everyone feels.
Yeah. Yeah.
Finally made some progress on it last week, but thanks to being kicked in the pants by a friend. So, we're towards the end of the time for this episode, unless somebody has something to add or that you guys want to close on.
No, I'd like to do an episode one day on that interesting question.
Which one?
The why do we seek you know, why do we seek hard things? Why do we seek that and then call them, in every other point in life when we're not seeking them, call them bad, but seek them.
It is interesting, otherwise. Right?
We do seek them.
I think athletic pursuit is one of those ones where that really brings that question to a head, because I was thinking about, I started mountain biking again. After a couple of weeks, went on like these grueling 24-mile rides.
Oh, I really felt it on my first day back snowboarding.
Yeah.
Oh,
right?
My God. And praying to Jesus.
Oh, yeah. Or even,
dear Lord, baby Jesus, save me from this mountain.
My brother and I went to Mammoth a couple of weeks ago. And for the first run, we got there. And I hadn't been snowboarding in like 4 days, which, I mean, for a lot of, that's not that long. But it was
four whole days.
Enough. But
suffer for Jesus.
And we haven't been riding together in 3 weeks. And I'm like, let's go to the top. Let's just go to the very top. Let's go to the top cornice of the mountain. Mm-hmm. And we get there, and then there's two paths. There's one that's like easiest way down the mountain. It's still black or whatever. And then there's one that's like, literally, it's got like warning signs.
Don't do this.
Yeah, experts only.
You're going to die.
And I'm like, let's go. First run. And I get to the top of the edge.
I always think when I see this, I'm like, why would you even make this run? Like, you're going to die if you go to this. This should not be an option.
And it had been 3 weeks since it had last snowed. So everything was very icy. And this is all too steep to groom. And I kind of didn't think about it until I get to the edge. And it's all really big ice moguls for anybody who skis. And on a snowboard, those are a little harder to navigate than skis, because when you are actually facing down the mountain and have the board narrow enough, you're picking up speed very rapidly.
Yeah.
And then it's hard to stop on that ice there. So I look over the edge and I look at my brother. I'm like, oh man, I did not know what I was getting into for this first run. And yeah, you just suffered through the first half.
You passed up Skull and Crossbones and a Don't Do This sign. And you're like, I didn't know what I was getting into.
Right.
Well, 90% of the time you pass those, it's totally fine.
You mean this is going to be hard?
Yeah. And I get halfway down and finally it opens up. And then what was like fear, pain, all this for the first half mile or whatever, I look back at the top and it's just like, holy cow, I did that.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a good question that you brought up before, Scott. And I think what's interesting within organizations is that certainly one of the problems is that we've made failure not an option.
Yeah, right?
I'll
tell you what, we struggled with that a little bit this year.
Yeah, yeah. And I think one of the brilliance of so many of these Silicon Valley firms is that they've made failure an important part of the culture, right? Mm. You need to fail early and you need to fail fast.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly in software, that should be the mantra.
Yeah.
But it should be in any company as well. Any innovative company, they're gonna push failure quickly.
Yeah. The ability to admit failure,
mm-hmm.
I think, is just crucial if to be happy.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's like from the Christian perspective, it's like your ability to confess your sins, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't believe you're a sinner, you don't confess your sins, the bad part of that is you're never going to be absolved. Yeah,
exactly.
And not in this works way, but like literally you will not let go of those sins to be...
No, I don't... The people that listen to the show know I'm not talking about earning their confession or anything like that. But I'm just saying, if you know, the impossible, let me struggle to phrase this the way I want to. The impossible sin to forgive is the one that you think you don't need Jesus for. So, I mean, if you're walking around saying Jesus didn't, it's obvious sin. Jesus didn't die for that, obviously, because there's nothing wrong with it. That's what Luther's talking about in small called articles when he talks about open sin, is this idea that you're walking around doing these things that are obviously sin, and you're obviously a sinner, and you're literally proclaiming Jesus didn't die for that. That's bad. That's the same thing with sort of in the secular context, is the hardest thing to get over is failing, but if you never admit that it's a failure, you would literally never get past it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I couldn't agree more. And I'm sorry to shift this to what I'm working on now, but that's why I would argue that it's so important for humans to have that ritual space where confession and absolution is always there. Mm-hmm. At least every Sunday. It's got to be there every Sunday.
Yeah.
But it provides that framework for us to look at sin and look at the brutal reality that we live in.
Yeah, that is us.
That is us.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I think that's it's an interesting, it'd be an interesting show. You should put it in your little fancy notepad.
Yeah, I should put it in my iPad there. Well, hey there. Thank you for listening to this episode. Again, I'll have a full list of show notes. At the top of those show notes will be Faithless to Fearless, the event that changed the world. You know, you'll have already heard the apologetic episode on this, which covers the main content of this book. And then, you know, now you can look forward to a great little postscript on happiness at the end, and you can listen to it or read it maybe after listening to this episode and have something to think about. And if you have further questions, comments, future show ideas, you can always email us. There's a contact button on the 1517.org website. And if you've been benefiting from the Thinking Fellows for some time now, I highly encourage you to help us support the show financially. Again, you can go to 1517.org/donate, and there you can set up an affordable, reoccurring monthly donation. All right, thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time. Bye.
Bye.